$5. Mr. Carpenter, when you're ready.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Kenneth Carpenter appearing on behalf of Mr. George Singleton.
Speak up, Mr. Carpenter, so I can hear you.
Sorry, Your Honor. Kenneth Carpenter appearing on behalf of Mr. George Singleton. We appeal a decision from the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims in which the court below held that the Secretary's interpretation of 38 CFR 3.344 was not plainly erroneous or inconsistent with the regulation, and therefore the procedural protections provided by that regulation were inapplicable to a retroactive assignment based upon the VA's practice of stage ratings. Mr. Singleton's appeal to this court addresses the question of whether or not he was or was not entitled to due process notice and an opportunity to be heard before the Board of Veterans Appeals discontinued its partial award of a total rating for a period of more than 10 years.
Could you start with the waiver question, not having raised, I mean, there's no dispute, right, that the due process question was not raised
Was not raised below.
I guess this issue is of greater concern to me than in many cases, simply because, you know, we're setting a precedent for you to drive a truck through in later times. So I just wonder what the theory is that we would hear this, even though it had not been raised below.
Well, we believe that we had a legitimate argument on the basis of the regulation. The regulation argument was presented. The regulation argument was rejected by the court. The result of that is that because they apply the VA's practice of staged ratings, the court below did, and we did not obviously know the result ahead of time.
But that's true. I guess I'm having a hard time seeing why that is not the case in every case you or other advocates bring before us. One, you've obviously lost, that's why you're appealing. And two, presumably you've lost on the regulatory and statutory basis, and therefore, is it your view that in every one of those cases where you've lost on the regulatory and statutory basis, you can come up here with a new due process argument?
No, Your Honor. In this case, the regulation provided due process, and we were relying upon that due process. The regulation, 3.344, requires notice and an opportunity to be heard. It says to the VA, when there is a total rating in place for more than 10 years, you're not going to reduce that rating without giving the veteran notice and an opportunity to be heard.
So it gives due process to people who, as the court construed it, do not include your client and others in his situation. So the problem, it seems to me, Judge Prost's question still stands, which is, if you're in that situation of having a regulation read so that the benefits of the regulation, be they due process type benefits or otherwise, do not extend to your client, does that free you from the obligation of having argued that if the court were to construe the regulation as the government was urging, that it would be an impermissible constitutional violation?
Well, I believe it does, Your Honor, because of the nature of this regulation and the as applied circumstances in this case. The board was presented with a situation in which it was remedying an error of omission on the part of the VA for more than two decades in failing to adjudicate a pending claim. When the pending claim was finally adjudicated more than two decades later, he prevailed, ultimately got a total rating. Then he had to argue about the effective date in order to recover that effective date. It is the VA's error in not adjudicating this, and that was a denial of due process. He initiated his appeal in 1981 following the VA's adverse decision.
Okay, I don't know, but the due process violation you're alleging here is different, right? It's just that he didn't, I mean, I guess this, going to the merits of due process, if we can translate, transcend to that, he had the right to be heard on the whole issue of the stage rating. Indeed, he requested that they do a stage rating. So he obviously had an opportunity to present his evidence as to why, presumably, his argument was, I got 100% for 25 years or 30 years. And he had the right to appeal the ultimate stage rating. So even assuming that due process applies, I am not understanding what the failure, why this process was insufficient.
Because the issue changed. The issue that was before the board was, what is the appropriate rating during this 20-year period?
Right.
And in that process, the board determined for a period of more than a decade, Mr. Singleton was entitled to a total rating. We believe that then gave him a property interest in the continuation of that total rating. That total rating then was discontinued without any notice to him from, I believe it's 1991 to the year 2000. And in that time frame, there...
I don't understand. There was notice to him. They issued a decision which he had the right to appeal to the Veterans Court.
Right, but he did not have the opportunity to address to the board why his total rating should have been continued after 1991.
Well, sure he did. In the first instance, he had the opportunity. He knew that he asked for a stage rating. He asked for a stage rating this period. He made his case, presumably. That was his opportunity to make the case as to why 100% rating should apply throughout the period, right?
And he prevailed in that argument essentially for a half a loaf. He prevailed that he was entitled
right.
for half of that period to 100% rating.
And then he gets to appeal that decision to the Veterans Court, correct?
That's correct. But the question, the legal question is was that or was that not protected? If that had been a prospective determination, if they had correctly responded to his notice of disagreement in the 1980s and they had granted him the benefit and assigned him 100% rating in 1980, prospectively to 1991. At that point in time in 1991, under the provisions of 3.344A, they would have been required to give him notice before they reduced that.
Right, that's a regulatory, I'm sorry.
Right.
Mr. Carpenter, the exact sequence of events in this case, a little hard to keep in mind because it kept going back and forth. But as I recollected the record, it indicated that it went this stage rating issue went before the board, then went up, then went back to the board. The board heard it a second time.
Well, that's not exactly right, Your Honor. It went to the court on the question of whether he was entitled to an earlier effective date. The court found that there was a pending claim and remanded it to the board. For instructions under the Fenderson Doctrine to apply stage ratings back to 1980.
Right. So the question of the stage ratings and what they were was before the board, right?
Correct.
And he had an opportunity before the board to make his argument as to why he was entitled to 100% rating for the entire period.
Correct.
Right?
Correct.
He had to understand that it's possible the board might rule otherwise. Otherwise, there would be no issue before the board.
Right.
So the board then said, we'll give you 100% except for that one period, we give you 70%. Your argument seems to be that at that point, they should have said to him, we've ruled against you on the case that you brought to us. And since we've ruled against you, you now are entitled under due process to another hearing as to why we ruled against you. Is that?
I'm sorry, I don't believe that correctly frames the argument, Your Honor. They didn't rule against him, they ruled in his favor. And it's the ruling in his favor that generates the right to the protection and the right to the notice.
But they also ruled against him on that one period, 70%.
And that is the question. Should they have given him notice and opportunity to be heard?
That we're going to rule against you on part of your stage rating when you knew we were doing a stage rating. I'll tell you what's worrying me about this, and that is if we were to rule against the government in this case, could the government come up and say, well, we had a hearing and we knew there was a possibility you could rule against us, but now you've ruled against us, we want another hearing. Is that That seems to me to be what your argument comes down to.
Respectfully, Your Honor, it's not. Because in this case, we're dealing with the special circumstances of a 20-year retrospective evaluation. An evaluation that was necessitated by the VA's error in the first place. The board got that. They were supposed to, at the direction of the court, do that staged rating. They didn't. They sent it back down to the agency. The agency assigned a 10% rating. We had to get it back before the board, and then the board did what the court ordered them to do in the first place.
You're not contesting any of that.
Except I'm demonstrating that, once again, due process was ignored because the board arbitrarily decided to send it back to the VA. The VA gave them a 10% rating for that 20-year plus
period. Let me ask you, if the board issued the staged rating decision of the board that I think you're arguing was not sufficient due process, if they had awarded 70% for the first 10 years and 100% for the second 10 years, then you wouldn't have a due process argument, right?
No.
No, yours because is only there was predicated not, on the, if there's a, okay, just so I understand.
There would not have been a reduction of that total rating. It's the fact that in this fact set, as applied, they did it just the opposite. The financial consequence to Mr. Singleton is more than $100,000. The difference between the 70% rating, which they reduced without an opportunity for him to be afforded the protection that he would have gotten had they not made the error in the first instance.
So you're very persuasive that the board acted arbitrarily and capriciously. Is that correct?
I sense a banana peel, but
with respect to Mr. Carpenter.
Yes.
with respect to the board, your basic concern is they didn't weigh the evidence correctly and they acted arbitrarily and capriciously, and you make a good argument.
But that goes.
Am I correct about that much?
Yes, Your Honor. I've allowed you.
But your problem is you can't get us to hear that. Isn't that correct?
Well, I believe you need to hear this, Your Honor. I believe that this is within your jurisdiction because it is a constitutional question. What happened to Mr. Singleton in this case is that the board gave him a protected rating and then they didn't protect it. The VA, by regulation at 38 CFR 20.903B, has a regulation that expressly provides that if in the course of their decision making they decide they're going to rely upon an issue, a case, or a statute or regulation that wasn't relied upon the VA, they're going to take a time out and they're going to give notice and an opportunity to be heard. There's nothing different between that regulation and asking them in the context of staged ratings to do the same thing, to take that time out, to give the notice and the opportunity, because there is a difference between a reduction of a total rating as opposed to entitlement to that total rating in the first instance. Those are different legal issues and different legal standards. And the continuation of that, the benefit is in favor of the veteran for the continuation, as opposed to the burden is on him to show entitlement to that in the first instance. If the VA had granted, or excuse me, if the board had granted a total rating for a period of 20 years, that 20-year rating would have been protected. And then there would have been no possibility of a reduction after that. But because it was 10 and 10, and now after 2001, he already has another 100%, his continuous rating at 100% is interrupted and it can't get protected until it's been continuous for 20 years. And that's the significance of this due process violation in addition to the money. It's that denial of the opportunity to be heard on the issue as it has changed based upon the application of the staged rating process. See that I'm way into my time and I'll...
Very well, we'll save you a couple of minutes for rebuttal. We'll hear from Ms. Markey.
May it please the court. I guess we'll begin at the end, as I often do, with the timeout idea, which I think, as we pointed out in our brief, doesn't make any kind of administrative sense. to time out a process, to tell a decision maker that halfway through his or her weighing of the evidence, he finds this is the decision I'm going to issue, and so I'm only going to issue a part of it. And
then is it your view that assuming you know there's a property interest that inures sort of looking back, turning the time clock back, that due process is satisfied under the procedures available here?
Yes, assuming that due process applies here, it's been more than satisfied. In listening to the discussion that just took place, I want to just point out that some of the discussion went off in an area that would be peculiar to this case, but only because the Veterans Court and the claimant requested it to be that way, in the sense, and let me just explain. Normally, in a staged rating, it would be issued by the regional office. And so, in this case, the original staged rating, well, actually, the original staged rating, I guess, was issued by the regional office because of the snafu and the regional office issuing its decision before the board re-pulled it back in granting the motion for reconsideration that counsel filed. But let's just say in a normal case, the regional office would issue a stage rating in the initial instance. And, of course, at that time, the claimant would have an opportunity to challenge that stage rating before the VA in the form of an appeal to the board and then subsequently to the Veterans Court. And so although this court may not be able to handle or review the sort of factual intricacies of whether or not there should have been a 170-100 stage rating in the normal process, not only would you have the RO, but a DRO, say, if you asked for a DRO review after the RO, and the board and the Veterans Court certainly all have jurisdiction to review that. So there's process all throughout this type of a question. Here, the odd thing was that when the Veterans Court got the case in the first time in 2006, it determined that there was an error with respect to the effective date, sent it back to the board and instructed the board to do the stage ratings. The board confirmed the effective date and then sent the stage rating part to the regional office. Mr. Singleton challenged that, requested the board to make it in the first instance. While that motion was pending, the regional office issued its 10% rating, but then subsequently the board grants the motion for reconsideration and does the stage rating process, resulting in the 170-100 award. The one thing we have to make clear throughout this is, and it's sort of undergirds all of Mr. Singleton's arguments, is this idea that there was some sort of deprivation or a change. The award that grants the 70 was the same award that grants the 100 on either side of it, or the 50, 70, 100, I think it was. And so there was, that's why 3.105 isn't implicated here. 3.105.
Had he previously been awarded 100% for this period?
No, the award, the staged rating award was made in the same decision. So no, when he was...
No prior decision in his favor.
There's no prior decision
undone.
That was
undone. That doesn't mean that there's no decrease.
Certainly not.
Yeah, so there was no decrease.
And as this court held in Stetzel and in Reisenstein when dealing with 3.343 and in Stetzel dealing with 5112 and 3.105 is the regulatory implementation of 5112. The focus about this protection is always about the deprivation of an existing benefit, an existing grant, someone who's in continuous receipt of compensation and who then has that taken away, basically, as we indicated in our brief, under the VA system, gets more process than did Mr. Matthews did, you know, when he filed his case in Matthews.
Right. And as I recall the argument
He gets a pre-termination in the VA process. They give him a pre-termination hearing, a right to be heard under 3.105 and 5112 before the discontinuation takes effect. That's the 60-day period, which Mr. Singleton is arguing should apply in this case, but the difference is, in this case, there wasn't any continuation of benefits that was deprived. The actual award of the benefit had multiple parts. So it's similar, like Judge Plager, you sort of made the point later, if the court were to kind of grant this kind of relief and talk about the truck driving through, wouldn't you have in any kind of, even a construction case or a trial court case, where full relief wasn't granted by the trial court rather than appeal to the appellate court, you automatically get a right under due process to a new hearing on that part of your request of relief that wasn't fully granted. Essentially, that's what's being asked here, is rather than go through the appellate process, as it currently exists, we're giving you an automatic re-review at the board level if your full relief isn't granted. And we don't think that's what due process stands for. Here, the due process, the notice was provided, to go through the joint appendix. The key documents are, the notice is contained in the Veterans Court's decision at JA 48 and 49, which specifically identifies the fact that we're going to send this back for a stage rating and that Mr. Singleton can provide evidence. Now, Fenderson itself, which was cited in the Veterans Court case and was the first precedential Veterans Court decision which references the VA's practice of stage ratings, was another case that involved a decrease. The facts of Fenderson were that the individual had filed a claim, and it was about 6 or so years before he finally got his benefits. And at the time they granted the benefits, there was an issue of migraine headaches that he was complaining of. And at the outset, when he filed his claim, and for a couple of years before that, he was experiencing migraine headaches at the frequency of like 2 or 3 times a week. But by the time the final decision came in Fenderson, it was down to about once every couple of months. And the schedule of ratings that applies to migraines is key toward the frequency of the migraine headaches. And so when the RO issued a decision in Fenderson, it granted him a 10% award, which would be consistent with having a migraine every couple of months. But Mr. Fenderson argued, wait a minute, that initial award was wrong because you were ignoring evidence in the record from my earlier period of appellate review. And the Veterans Court agreed, sent it back, and said, do a staged rating. And what that meant was, you can give him a rating in which you might get the 30% rating for 1988 to 1992 or something like that, where he was experiencing migraines at the frequency of a couple of times a week, recognizing, though, that that initial award would include the rating going down toward the 92, 94 time period and, recognizing that the frequency had decreased. So the very first case, in the case referenced here, it's premised on this idea that when you do a staged rating, you might have a decrease. And so when...
The other cases you refer to where we've dealt with the stage ratings and we've mm-hmm. distinguished, and I think the government has taken the position, you get extra process if you've had an amount of money, a check coming in.
Right, that's and we agree, they're not due process cases. They're regulatory and statutorily based cases, looking at the plain language of those regulations and statutes and saying that it's a prospective type thing. If you are in current receipt of the benefits, compensation, in other words, I think Stetzel was a rating went down, but it didn't affect the overall compensation, so 5112 wasn't implicated. The idea is that if you're in receipt of the compensation and that is reduced so that what you got in your veteran's check last month is now less or would be less, 3.105 is implicated, and you have 60 days to challenge that or get used to it under 3.105. That never happened here. When he got his veteran's check,
But somebody has made a policy decision along the way that extra process is, the veteran is entitled to extra process, I think, for the policy consideration that they've developed a lifestyle or incurred expenses
some of the,
predicated on the understanding, and that doesn't exist for stage ratings, right?
No, it doesn't. The idea is the Veterans Court talked about here, and this court talked about in Reisenstein, when you enter the appellate process, like Mr. Singleton did here, when he entered the appellate process, he had less than what he came out of the appellate process with. Sorry about the preposition. But basically, he got more by going through the appellate process. His overall numbers when he went in were zero, okay, during this whole time period. At some point, the RO actually gave him 10%. But when he gets done with the board, he's at 50, 70, and 100, or 50, 170, or something like that. It's better than zero, and that's the same decision awarded that. So when he gets that check, it's got all this extra money in it, but it's not lower than the one he was receiving before he started the appellate process. And that's why stage ratings can't implicate 5112 or 3.105. And so here, Mr. Singh, as our brief, I think, goes right through the steps, he received a right to make the argument. His argument would have included the entire 20-year period. I'm entitled to 100% throughout the period. The board disagreed and dropped one down to 70%. That's the result of the decision. And he had a right to challenge that and did so challenge that. And now has argued that he needs more process, but we think that already there's been sufficient process in this case.
What about on the waiver point? Does the is the government concerned that the application of a
We agree. I mean, that's why we make the claim that it wasn't raised below. You know, the Supreme Court and this court have indicated that failure to preserve your constitutional claim at the Veterans Court, well, this court, with respect to the Veterans Court, via.
Yeah, but Mr. Carpenter is right. I mean, in that the argument he was making, the statutory and regulatory argument he was making below sort of implicated the exact, I mean, it was due process by another
right, name. But right, but I think Your Honor made a fair point, too, not to pile on, but that, that you know, just because you have several arguments to make and you make one of them doesn't mean, you know, you waive the others. He could have easily made the due process at the same time. And actually, it brings
but
up
the
this,
due process argument, I guess, would really, well, it wouldn't necessarily, I suppose, depend on losing on the statutory or regulatory argument, but it certainly doesn't really come into prominence if you have, let's, suppose the following. Suppose that you have a rock solid statutory or regulatory argument when you go into the court, and so you rely entirely on that rock solid argument, or what you think is rock solid, and sure enough, the court completely out of the blue says, no, we're changing our prior law, and we are now going to construe the regulation in a way, a regulation which gave you all these due process-like rights, we're going to construe that regulation much more narrowly than we ever have before, in a way that deprives you of all those rights. Do you then, as Mr. Carpenter, I think, would say, do you then get to go to the appellate court and say, number one, we think that the court misapplied the proper construction of the regulation and statute, and number two, if they got that right, then they've got a constitutional problem. You have no reason to expect that they would ever have to get to the constitutional problem, but suddenly it comes into flower.
The answer to that question is, frankly, this court has the authority to ignore a waiver argument. So ultimately, it's this court's decision. We can present our opinion, which is, in this case, it should have been obvious.
Well, what would you do with those cases if you were us?
I think it'd be a hard call, and that there, I'm certain that there would be times when, if I were privileged to make that decision, I would say this case, the procedure and facts and nature of the argument in this case were such that it couldn't have been reasonably expected that the court would go this way, and so therefore, and in nature of the holding, which also couldn't be reasonably respected, was such that it implicates due process, and so we're going to entertain that case.
But you don't think this is...
Oh, no, I don't think this, because this is a due process argument. He's trying to argue that certain regulations which... You know, that afford due process, I mean, it's that kind of thing. The other argument I would note is the Forsey argument, our second argument, the prudential thing, which I think is very strong in this case, because Fenderson was exactly about the kind, you know, Fenderson announced stage ratings, and in this case, Mr. Singleton requested that very action on the part of the board, but then now says that somehow that was lost due process because of that, yet it was the exact sort of action that the board followed in response to his motion for reconsideration. So,
on the waiver argument, I assume that you would argue his due process is keyed to a regulation that he was already raising before the Veterans Court. This is not a freestanding process argument.
That's an interesting question. Yes. The more you, I think, focus on the argument that's raised, it becomes less a freestanding constitutional argument and more a question of whether or not the regulations and statutes related to the notice are constitutionally sound. I think that does, in preparing for the argument today, that's something we were talking about, was the freestanding, you know, if you look at the reply brief at page 2.
What is a freestanding due process argument?
The reply brief at page 2 says it's a freestanding argument, and in the next paragraph it talks about how, well, really, had we properly applied the regulations here, the process would have been provided. Which
but
seems
in terms
to be
of 7292, it doesn't matter, right? Because either...
Oh, either, this court will entertain either. I mean, In re Bailey
it's was... It's a freestanding.
In re Bailey was, but then before that, right. Well before that, this court's entertained constitutional statutes and regulations.
Okay, Mr. Carpenter.
I'd like to begin with the trying to recast the context of this situation. This is essentially a continuous claim from 1980. The notion that there wasn't a original award, as was suggested by the government, is simply incorrect. There was an original award. They made an original award based upon a reopened claim effective August 2001. They eventually gave him a 100% rating from August of 2001 forward, and he appealed the effective date, eventually prevailed on the effective date, and got a continuous claim from 1980. Now, the due process protections that he was supposed to have been entitled to, such as a statement of case in response to his notice of disagreement, were not afforded to him. He then gets to the board, where the board is finally doing the ultimate analysis of what the rating should be from 1980 to 2001. The board ends up deciding that for a period of a decade, he is entitled to a 100% rating. The government's position amounts to there is a difference at law between retrospective and prospective ratings. And they prevailed on that argument in their regulatory context. The question is that valid in the constitutional context as applied to this case? As applied in this case, there was a reasonable opportunity for the board to have taken a break, made a partial award, and said, we are considering a reduction and we are giving you notice of that because the issue has now changed. It's no longer entitlement to 100%, it's entitlement to a continuation of that 100%. And you have the right to notice and an opportunity to be heard on that issue. That issue is fundamentally different than the rating to be assigned. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you. We thank both counsel.